Alaskans were more than happy to talk about big ideas for renewable energy last month. Now, let's see what pencils out. It's time once again for the annual Business of Clean Energy Conference. One kind of business should be done. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Call 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call of 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Our utilities have a project to look at renewable energy, and the head of it is with us today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The Association of Alaska School Boards believes that all students should be proficient in reading, writing, and math by the time they finish the third grade. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, I grew up in the newspaper industry, and my grandfather was a founder of a newspaper, and he was also the founder of a Rotary Club. Why? Because it's good for business is why. He's in the business of selling advertising, so naturally he wanted to have a Rotary where all the business people that might want to buy advertising would get together. I used to really sneer at this sort of thing back in my rebellious days, but I've gotten to like these schmoozathons in the business community. I know a whole lot of those people now, and it's just a whole other way of looking at things. So it's kind of thrilling to see a business conference that is oriented around renewable energy, or clean energy, as they're calling it. And the Renewable Energy Alaska Project is funded mostly by the utilities, and their executive director is a frequent guest on this program and is back with us again. Chris Rose, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to be back.
So is there a particular theme this year to the conference?
Yeah, the theme, I think, is to look at what the business opportunities are for Alaska. Now, the conference is designed so we can bring experts from around the country and around the world into the state so they can share experiences, best practices, and what's going on around the world. This is a big business now. It's about a $250 billion a year business, and that's doubled just in the last 5 years. And so we're looking at it growing very quickly, and we see Alaska as becoming part of that, but we have to find our niche. And so we bring people together to talk about what those technologies and things that we could be doing here in Alaska are that can make us part of this next industrial revolution, which is what a lot of people are calling it.
We used to talk about, you used to come on here and you'd say, well, they're doing this over in Scandinavia and they're doing this in Iceland and they're doing this in China. But here, not that much yet. Some ideas. I sense that there's been some momentum that is built up.
Well, absolutely. No, since 2008, when the legislature passed the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, over 200 projects have been funded with that program alone. Many of them have already gone into design and construction, and we're displacing millions of gallons of diesel out in the villages with those. We've got two wind projects happening now in the rail belt. We've got geothermal exploration going on out at Mount Spur. We've got lots of hydro projects around the state already and maybe more to come. So there's a lot going on the renewable generation side. And then on the energy efficiency and conservation side, more and more is happening. The state passed a goal in 2010 to reduce our energy use by 15% by 2020. And there's a lot of state agencies that are working hard to get us there. So when you combine energy efficiency and renewable energy, that's what we call clean energy. It's just a combination of the both.
You spoke of an Alaska niche. What do you think it's likely to be? Do you think it might be in the rural area? Because that's certainly where everybody wants to see energy savings. And it seems as if the price of diesel is so costly, and many of these power plants are so inefficient yet, that there's room for improvement there, and that might be reproducible technology.
Right. I think that is true. We've got all these small microgrids, over 200 isolated communities that just exist on diesel, and some of them have renewables as part of that now. But These are villages that already have, as you said, super high prices. And so if you were going to do, let's say, a 60 cent per kilowatt hour tidal project in the lower 48, that doesn't save anybody money. You can do a 60 cent per kilowatt hour tidal project in Alaska and start saving people money with a demonstration or pilot project. So we are the perfect laboratory or test bed for a lot of technologies that are just emerging that cost a little bit more now because they're not commercialized yet. We could be demonstrating those technologies here, optimizing them, making it more affordable for our own citizens, and then putting together some models that we could export.
I'm looking at the agenda of the program, the Business of Clean Energy Conference. Is there still room for people to show up and participate in this?
Oh, absolutely. If folks go to either the REAP website or the bceaconference.com website, you can register online. The conference is Thursday and Friday, April 19th and 20th at the Dena Center, downtown Anchorage. And we will have experts from around the country, as I mentioned before. One of our keynotes is John Wellinghoff, who's the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, coming from Washington, D.C. Another person who's coming from D.C. who will talk is a real interesting guy, Denny McGinn, who's the president of ACOR, the American Council on Renewable Energy, which is essentially the National Trade Association for Renewable Energy. And he's a retired admiral and national defense strategist who now has his niche in renewable energy. So both of these folks will talk about how renewable energy and energy efficiency is really impacting the United States and the world to give us that perspective to get the conference off to a start.
And I was also kind of interested in this Mark Sinclair guy, the Clean Energy States Alliance, the guy from Vermont.
Well, the Clean Energy States Alliance is a great group that has essentially formed a network of all the states in the country that have renewable energy grant funds, like Alaska has now. And Mark heads that up. He knows a lot about the different policies that are being implemented around the country. And so he'll actually be on the policy panel that talk about what's going on in other states, because long-term policy is so important. The certainty that you get from knowing what the rules of the game are going to be way in advance really helps business development. Of course, that's what we're seeing all over the place. That's what all the debates about oil taxes are about. And in any kind of business environment, you've got to have the rules of the game set up.
Well, it's just sort of come by in passing. I mean, politics get very intense towards the end of the session, but it looked to me as if there might have been a deal to fully fund the Renewable Energy Fund again.
Well, we won't know that till the very end, because the capital budget is what contains that number. But we're very hopeful that the Renewable Energy Grant Fund will be given another $43.2 million this year. That would fund all the projects that Alaska Energy Authority recommended back in the fall. The other exciting thing is it looks like the legislature is going to pass a bill to extend the Renewable Energy Grant Fund another 5 years. It's now set to expire in 2013, so this bill would extend it to at least 2018, and they're actually even talking about a 10-year extension, which would, again, give us long-term certainty for this kind of investment.
It's exciting times. Our guest is Chris Rose, Executive Director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project. He's been on the show before, and you pretty well know the drill. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422, and email us talk@alaskapublic.org. I got to tell you, Chris, we had, with some help from you, actually, in arranging the panel, we put together a panel on big energy ideas and asked people to call up. We have Brian Hirsch in here from the Renewable Energy Laboratory, right?
National Renewable Energy Lab.
And people had if you think big, people have a lot of ideas. You know, and I got Scott chimed in with all this stuff about dirigibles we didn't even have time for. But we do have one thing that seemed to come out of this was you really need to look at how you use your energy.
That's right.
And then how do you provide that? How do you deal with that rather than saying, okay, we're going to have all these power lines. We're going to have all these things. What do you need? Do you need heat? You need a liquid fuel. You know, there was talk in Sitka. I don't know how it's going, but they were starting to go over to electrical vehicles. And there was thinking even that they might be able to eliminate combustion vehicles pretty much entirely, because it really would be more economical with the short length of trips and everything, to just use the electric vehicles.
Well, you're absolutely right.
And that would be revolutionary. I mean, wouldn't that be something that would make the news all across the country, or maybe not? Maybe other places are doing that,
no,
too.
No, I think it would in the United States, because there's not that many places that have, for instance, in Sitka, 12 miles of road, Juneau, 40 miles of road. There's no range anxiety in places like that with electric vehicles.
Right.
And if they plan out ahead, which they're looking at doing, to get more hydro capacity online, then they might be able to move that way. But you're absolutely right in terms of using your energy and figuring out how you use it is the first thing to do. And that's essentially energy efficiency. So you're putting in equipment and technology that's getting better all the time to give you the same service with less energy. We're looking now in the state of Alaska, conservatively, we're going to spend $65 billion on liquid fuel in this state over the next 20 years. $65 billion exported out of our economy. Sitka just looked at their own little economy there. They're looking at spending $1 billion just in Sitka on liquid fuels in the next 20 years. So if we look at that 15% goal and we say, well, how can we save Sitka $150 million over the next 8 years or so to reach that goal by 2020, that's the kind of frame we're looking at. It's like, how do we save money and save energy? Because we don't have to give anything up. Conservation is, you know, putting the sweater on when it's cold out, but energy efficiency does the work for you without any kind of sacrifice. And there's a lot of movement with AEA and HFC and other entities around the state to help us save energy. HFC's programs are saving on average 30 to 33% energy in the homes that they've weatherized over the last 3 or 4 years. That's huge.
Is that program, can people still get in on that home energy audit program?
Well, I know that there's a waiting list on both the rebate program and the weatherization program. The governor put $50 million in his budget for those programs this year.
Oh, good.
And we're hoping the legislature may even give more. So as the money keeps coming in from the legislature, the ability to open up that waiting list will continue.
There comes a point, Chris, where it really seems like design enters into it. And this goes back to my point. What is your energy use? What is your energy need? But if you are structured, I mean, what we have essentially, you go to any village in Alaska and you see appalling housing stock, by and large. Some of it built by HUD.
Right. Well, I was just back in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago, and I had some federal officials ask me, well, what can we do? And that was my answer. I said, well, you know, a lot of this inefficient housing was built by the federal government. Why don't you help Alaska become the most energy...
I'm so glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Not the first time. People are always bringing it up to me.
Sure. I mean, why do we have to look to Germany and Denmark and Sweden for the best design? Why can't Alaska, as the only Arctic state in the United States, become a leader in building technology and create an industry for ourselves and save people money?
Well, apropos of all that, Bruce chimed in right away saying, can you explain how we can use renewable energy to offset the other big use of fossil fuel in the village home and building heating, which is we were just starting on.
Right.
And efficiency is probably your number one.
Well, that's the first one. But in terms of generation, there is a move toward more biomass heating. In fact, the southeast area of the state, southeast Alaska, is unfortunately they're moving more toward using more diesel to keep up with the electric load because people are moving to electric heat. They're seeing electric heat is already being cheaper than oil heat. So the unintended consequence of all that is the hydroelectric utilities in southeast are having to fire up diesel generators to keep up with the electric load because people are moving to electric heat.
It's not supposed to work that way.
Right. And so the integrated resource plan that AEA just worked on for the region actually says, why not move more toward pellet heat? Wood pellet heat in southeast, the resource is being imported right now from Washington State. Sea Alaska Corporation in their office building downtown Juneau is using that already, saving money, using about 300 tons of that those pellets a year. There's a pellet mill down up in North Pole, Alaska now. So there's a possibility of creating a small pellet industry and using that for heat. There's also wood district heating that's going on in different places. There are wood systems at schools like in Tok and Delta that have a sustainable harvest of wood nearby. So that is one of the ways we can displace heating with renewable energy.
And the last time we talked about it, you were telling me that there is there's actually off-the-shelf, if you can afford it, off-the-shelf heat pump technology, especially if you're just starting to build.
Well, that's absolutely true, too, and that is also being looked closely at in Southeast Alaska. You know, the Sea Life Center now has a seawater heat pump that's heating their building because they're already pumping water up anyway. Same with the NOAA installation down in Juneau. There's more than a million ground source heat pumps installed in the lower 48, but it never had been really that economically viable in Alaska till the price of diesel got so high. So now the price of diesel is getting so high that all these technologies that may not have had an application in Alaska before do have one. Because, of course, we only use it for heating. In the lower 48, they use those heat pumps for heating and cooling. So you get a 12-month return on investment. Up here, you're only getting, you know, 6-8 months of it. But even at that, now they're becoming more viable. And, you know, the Juneau Airport just put in a ground source heat pump.
1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, the telephone number is 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're talking about the business of clean energy, where the rubber meets the road, where the investment is actually made, and how is the best investment, where's the best payback, and what are the technologies that are appropriate to Alaska, and technologies in which indeed Alaska could even pioneer. So I'm still thinking we can do more with load management in the rail belt. I'm very disappointed with those tests that they did where they said, well, we might be running out of natural gas, so let's take certain hours and everybody conserve. And then, and you know, of course, you're involved with the utilities, but it just seemed to me that this was not put in the optimum way to the public. And nor was the analysis satisfactory to me as to what kind of results they got. But they got a pitifully small result compared to what they got in Juneau when they all of a sudden had to fire up the diesel. They said, okay, guess what? Your electricity is going to cost twice as much now.
Yeah, it was five times as much, I think.
And
that's what motivates people. I think it's good that the city's trying to educate people about the situation, but there has to be so much more of this. Energy is the lifeblood of our economy. If people don't know where their energy comes from, what the implications of energy choices are, they can't be informed consumers. They can't, you know, get folks into positions that will make energy decisions for them. And it's super important. I mean, I've heard people, very intelligent people, say that they had no idea where their electricity was produced. And it's just like the, you know, food comes from the store. Electricity comes from a hole in the wall. And unfortunately,
it is the same, isn't it? It is exactly the same.
It's very similar, and it's makes us vulnerable. It really makes us vulnerable. You know, we're importing 98% of our food here. You know, you've had shows about this.
Oh, yeah.
We are very much more vulnerable now to swings in natural gas prices than we were when we had a little isolated gas market.
Well, no, all the time I've been here, we've gone from the cheapest natural gas in the country to the most expensive. How's that?
Right. And so understanding what the market is for natural gas and for the fossil fuels is an integral part of understanding what the market is for renewables, because the whole thing with renewables is a little bit more upfront cost, but then no fuel cost the entire life of the project. And so there's tons of certainty in knowing what the cost of your energy is going to be for 20 or 25 years. And businesses and investment firms and people who do try to make a living doing this, they understand that. They understand that certainty, even if it's a little bit higher today, makes a big difference for them.
I'm really wondering about on down the line what will happen in Southeast. I mean, you've talked a little bit about the pellet idea, and it's clearly major production of biomass up there that really it doesn't have a use. I mean, we see that. I mean, you got logs, right? But what do you do with all the other stuff?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what you also have is you had this for better or for worse, Cascade Creek coming along and saying, hey, we want to put hydro on this entire watershed. We can generate all kinds of hydro. All we really need is to get that power line going up the Cassiar Highway and get it up through Bradfield or some way to get us into the grid, and we can be selling our power.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw a similar thing happen in Canada, where Quebec Hydro put in all this capacity, had way more power than it could use, and started selling it to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it, you know, it's a ways down the line, and it's probably more along the lines of the big energy ideas that we talked about last month.
Right.
But nonetheless, it would seem that the type of hydro resources they have in Southeast Alaska, not to mention the tidal resources, that energy is kind of a, you know, potential energy for sure, is kind of a neglected investment area.
Well, I think it is. And, you know, energy demand on this planet is expected to quadruple by the end of the century. So we keep asking the question, where is all the energy going to come from? Because the primary energy source we've all been using for the last 150 years is diminishing, and that's fossil fuels. So there is going to be a supply and demand that's going to increase the price of fossil fuels and make renewables way more attractive, and even the expensive transmission of renewables way more attractive. I think folks in Alaska, though, are rightly concerned that they are able to benefit from any renewable energy generation projects. It'd be great to have some income coming in the future from selling it, but I think particularly in Southeast, a lot of people I've talked to have said, well, let's not export electricity till we've got the electric transportation set up and that we've got, you know, enough electricity to maybe heat part of our buildings with it and supplement that with other sources of heating like biomass. But if you just start exporting it all, then you may not have enough for those things that your own communities may want.
Well, let's say that it was done, though. Let's say that there was all this capacity developed. And, of course, the use would be quite limited there. But once you had whatever the tide turbines or whatever that turn out to actually work and, you know, be applicable in Alaska and installed. If you did have all that power, it would seem to me that we're so far away that there'd be an awful lot of loss involved in moving that energy to somewhere else.
Well, advances in high voltage DC current lines will probably enable some transmission, some distances. There are some long distance lines being discussed right now, even between Iceland and Europe, which is a long way because they have so much geothermal and hydro in Iceland. So there's the potential for doing that. But one of the other things that we talk about, and maybe folks talk about a couple weeks ago on the show, is all what we call the stranded renewables. The entire Aleutian Chain, for instance, has got tons of geothermal, tons of tidal and wave power potential, great wind, but there's not that much of an electric load because not many people live out there. So a big investment in renewables may not pay off for the local population. But if you start thinking out of the box and saying, why don't we move some businesses to the energy? Why don't we start attracting businesses like, for instance, a server farm that needs cool air for cooling down the server and so on, and needs a lot of electricity? They could be located anywhere in the world potentially. So lots of business opportunities where we could bring the business to Alaska, not necessarily where a population exists in great numbers right now.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. And, of course, that's not going to be the sort of thing come up at your conference, right? Because this is kind of forward-looking, and you know, we're dealing with where investments might be made now.
That's true. And we have talked about those kinds of things in the past. I think we are focused more on things that can happen in the next 3 to 5 years. For instance, one of the folks we'll have who will be interesting to hear is the president of Verdant Energy, Trey Taylor, in New York City. Verdant just got the first commercial FERC license for tidal power in the United States. This is a big breakthrough. So this is not an exploration or demonstration license. This is for actually putting in a tidal power project right in front of the United Nations building in the East River. And he will talk about how his company has gotten there and, you know, the hurdles that he's overcome.
Wow, the East River.
Yep. Well, there's a company that has an office right here.
Around the 59th Street Bridge, now they think about it.
Yep, yeah. Well, they've got a demonstration project there on Roosevelt Island now. So.
Wow. So that's right in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But, you know, that's part of what we're talking about is tidal power is not here today, but it could very well be commercial the next 3 to 5 years. So that is something that we need to discuss and plan for here in the state of Alaska, since we have 90% of the country's tidal power potential.
Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project is with us again on Talk of Alaska. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email, which people are taking advantage of, talk@alaskapublic.org. And David joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, David.
Hello, yeah. I'd like to make maybe a comment or observation, question the state of Alaska seems to be not really very supportive of the idea of solar projects. When I've talked to them about it, it's not cost effective. And you know, I work with Arctic Village, and you know, they fly diesel 220 air miles to run their electrical generation system. And so I think to myself, if you can't make solar energy pay in an environment like that, I mean, is it going to work anywhere, you know? So the costs are just killing them. And I'm kind of wondering if you could comment on this whole idea of solar in the Arctic.
Sure. Well, you're right. The price of diesel is getting so high that solar photovoltaic, which is making electricity, is actually starting to get competitive. And that, in part, is also because the cost of solar panels, as you know, keeps coming down pretty darn quickly with the economies of scale that are being produced in China and other places. So price of solar is going down, price of diesel is going up. We also have a lot of solar thermal applications going in around the state already. So you're using solar to heat the water. I mean, heating water is actually a pretty big deal for a lot of people. You spend a lot of money heating water, and if you can heat that water on your roof or at least preheat it for much of the year, that makes a big difference. We obviously have a great solar resource about 7 months a year and a not-so-great resource 5 months of the year. But I think that as more people get plug-in vehicles, that applying solar to transportation is actually going to become a pretty big deal in Alaska, because that means 7 months a year with a plug-in hybrid, you could stop buying gasoline and you could be running your car off your roof. And then when the sun goes away, well, big deal. Your gas engine starts to kick in more during the winter. So I do think that if we start thinking, again, out of the box a little bit and applying solar to transportation rather than our electric load, which we don't have much of in the summer when the sun is shining, we'll have more applications for solar.
Yeah, and, you know, I did talk to somebody at the university, and they said, well, you know, you get most of your solar in the summer, and they don't really need solar in the summer. And, you know, in the village, you know, they talk about shutting off the generator in the summer because, well, it's the summer, but they can't, you know, to save money, to turn the generators off, stop burning diesel. But everybody's got their subsistence fish and meat in the freezers, and they can't turn it off on the hottest days of the year. You know,
oh, yeah, you wouldn't want to shut the freezers down, that's for sure.
No, you know, so you know, we've got planners out there, well, you don't need it in the summer, but the facts of the matter are they need it in the summer almost more than the winter, you know.
Well, yeah, that's true, and we have to just keep an eye on it because, again, price of solar is coming down, price of diesel is going up. It's inevitable. The lines will cross at some point, and solar will become a lot more viable in the state of Alaska, at least those 7 months a year.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I don't see solar, it can't be the only energy source, but some sort of hybrid. You know, when the sun's
right,
shining, you turn the generators off, and you're saving money. It would be a great thing.
Yeah, well, some sort of push-pull thing where if you could have some kind of source that was great in the dark, and then the other... And the solar is great in the light, then you'd have it all.
Well, and battery technology, energy storage of any kind, is a big component of this puzzle, too. And as battery storage and energy storage in general gets better, we'll be able to use intermittent sources like wind and solar a lot more efficiently.
Yeah, wind is not that great in the interior. You
no.
know, we just don't have that much wind, but we got a lot of sunshine, and in the winter when it's cooler and the snow is on the ground, I think... You know, we can. I think the state is underplaying the potential of solar, especially in the bush.
Well, I know the Energy Authority has looked at a few proposals for solar in villages, and more village utilities are looking at the concept of trying to integrate them into a hybrid system, as you mentioned. And it's a really good
right.
point. There's no silver bullet here. We have to use whatever we've got wherever we are. And in some places, that may mean integrating solar into a hybrid system.
And, you know, the other observation I would make is that if you don't have a large enough solar source to shut the generator off, then you really aren't getting anything.
Well, I actually had a question about that, David. I was in Arctic Village. It was quite a while ago, but they were working on a community cold storage there. How did that ever come out? Is that still around?
There were problems with that didn't really work out in the long run. It was sort of some you know, sort of community property type issues, maintenance and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
That didn't work.
Well, you're hitting on a point, though, David, that's really important. One of the niches Alaska has is the control technology that goes into these hybrid systems so that when you have, let's say, a wind diesel hybrid system, your controls are able to keep your diesels off as much as possible because that's where you get your benefit when the diesels are in an off mode. And those control systems are getting better and better at doing that.
And you don't need batteries to get you through the night or through the winter or whatever. You may need a battery to buffer the system for when
for a minute at a time or so.
Sunshine or to give the generator time to start up.
Right.
But I don't, you know, we're not looking to completely displace diesel. It's not going to be possible at this point. But if there was half as much money going out for diesel, that would be such a tremendous relief for the community, you know. I mean, it's killing these small villages right now.
Maybe we need to take a station break here, but I Bill Leedy's ideas of ammonia as a way of storing energy that you could bring in energy in the summer, and then that ammonia would just sit there until you're ready to use it. We're just lacking kind of the hardware of consuming that as a fuel, but not that far from it if you talk to Bill. David, thanks for your call there.
And, you know, the thing is that this stuff is being flown in, you know.
Yeah.
That's the thing that makes it, you know, different from the economics anywhere else. You know, 220 air miles, that's the same distance as Fairbanks to Anchorage. Can you imagine having to fly your diesel that distance?
Well, you're certainly not going to truck it, are you?
No, and you're not even barging it there either, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm just making some observations, and, you know, the thing that villages are facing, they're facing a 60, or, you know, do you start this, you're running a 60 kW generator. If you need more than that, you start the 90. If you're using less than 60 kW, you're still running the 60 kW generator. And you have to have a large enough solar facility to replace the generator, you know, because otherwise you're going to have to run the generator. And most of the solar projects that you'll see are small, and they really have very little effect on diesel use because the generator is still having to run.
David, those are great design considerations, and they really illustrate how far we have to go yet. Thanks for your call, David. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska,
and by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
It is Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. And, you know, last month we did a show kind of on the bluegrass, or the blue sky ideas, the big ideas in renewable energy. And people love to talk about it. So it was great to get that last call from somebody who works with Arctic Village and says, well, I can't really do it this way because of this, and we got this kind of power plant, and its limits are that. And you quickly realize when it comes to where the investment and design rubber meets the road, you're talking a whole other ball game. And that's why the business of clean energy is an important thing. And that conference is coming up, and it's an annual event put on by the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, bringing in people from all across the country and indeed from often other places in the world to talk about the business of renewable energy. And Chris Rose of REAP is with us now. Are you ready for some more calls here, Chris?
Sure. I just want to make a comment on what you just said about design, too, because that's part of the business, too. Look at Iceland. Iceland is exporting their expertise to design geothermal plants all around the world. This is part of what we're talking about. As we get better and better at things like wind diesel hybrid systems, we could be sending our expertise, our people from Alaska around the world to developing areas that want to put in these kinds of systems. So it's not just the building of these things or even the manufacturing of them. It's also the designing and implementing them that's important.
Yeah, we were talking about a little bit about ground source heat pumps a little while ago, and I had an email from Louisa who said, well, and one thing you said is, well, in the lower 48, you can get it both ways. You can both have cooling and heating, but here it's mostly just about the heating. And Louisa is saying, well, are they to the point now in, let's say, Anchorage with our price of natural gas fuel, are they right now to the point where it's worthwhile looking at, especially if you're doing a new building?
I think if you're doing a new building, absolutely. And you've got the space to put in geothermal, it's something you should have your architect or designer or contractor look into.
I can just picture that conversation right now.
Yeah, it does take some space. If you're starting with an existing building, you may or may not have it.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Eagle River and Jim from Eagle River. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim.
Yes, thank you. I've heard about algae lipids as a source of liquid fuel. You can make diesel out of it. You can burn it directly. Even in villages in Alaska, they get most of their sunlight when it's warm out, and they could have algae ponds and centrifuge crops every week and produce algae lipids. I understand that's been done on a small scale, but I haven't heard much about it. Seems like that's the way to go because it would reduce considerable, at least temporarily, carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And if you kept making algae lipids, if we replaced all our liquid fuel needs in the world, we'd reduce the carbon dioxide concentration by 80 or 90 parts per million.
Mm-hmm. I know that it came up a little bit on our show on the big ideas a while ago with the idea that when you talk about biomass, algae is one biomass that you don't want to neglect thinking about.
Well, that's absolutely true. And those are the kinds of projects that, for instance, the Department of Energy is looking at through the Advanced Research Projects Agency Energy, or ARPA-E. ARPA-E is based in D.C. They have their big conference at the end of February this year. I think Bill Gates and Bill Clinton were there, among a million other people. But the ARPA-E is really the think tank in the United States for looking at those kinds of things and starting to partner more with industry. At our own state level, we've got the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, which is another program that was looking at forward-thinking ideas like that, because it could be one of the things that we really will use a lot in the future, but it has not got to scale or commercialization yet.
I do know that there is a biofilm production plant on the Kona side on the Big Island in Hawaii that brings up cold water from deeper levels of the ocean and makes biofilms of some sort there.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are so many possibilities. Again, what we need to do is narrow down what's going to work in the near term, and keep researching for what's going to work in the long term. And that's one of the things we talk about. Someone from ARPA-E will be here at the conference in a couple weeks, and he'll be actually following a person from the United Nations who has now a new program called Sustainable Energy for All. So the United Nations is now saying, look, we've got 1.6 billion people on the planet with no electricity. We've got another billion people who have intermittent electricity. It's about a third of the world. It's a big market. These people don't have any money. How are we going to get them energy, and how are we going to get them clean energy? And so we feel like Alaska is perfectly poised to be part of helping that movement around the world, because a lot of people in the world live in small, isolated communities like we've got here in the state of Alaska.
Right, and it's not as if the colonizing culture was real great in finding appropriate technology for our villages. So maybe it's time to do some of that R&D here, so that other villages don't have to put up with unfortunate locations and schools too far from the village and many, many other things.
Well, the thing is that diesel's just going to keep going up.
Yeah.
We've got a supply and demand issue on this planet, and we're not going to see a precious commodity like oil get much cheaper. In fact, it's going to get more and more expensive. And if you rely on that for most of your heat and electricity, you're very vulnerable.
Jim and Eagle River, or anything more?
Well, it seems a lot of these alternatives require machinery that's produced with coal. And I did some rough calculations, and the total pollution from each car is half produced by its manufacturer and half by the oil it consumes if it gets 20 or 30 miles per gallon. So if you make the car a little more expensive and consume much less oil, you're not lowering the total pollution load by very much.
And this would be because of what, steel and smelting and so forth?
Yeah, the cost of the car is largely an energy cost. When you buy a new car, at least half of it is attributable to purchasing coal and burning diesel and power plants to generate the energy to melt the, all the components and manufacture the car. Some of it's profit, and that has its own problems. But even the wages, a lot of that goes to buying fossil fuel. So a lot of the cost of a car is fossil fuel that's already been burnt and produced carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So if everyone drove a car that had unlimited mileage, it wouldn't reduce the carbon dioxide problem very much at all. Maybe none, because cars that are cheap to drive get driven more.
Jim, you're right. I think the embedded energy in all these products is a thing that most people overlook. But we are moving, and that's why there's so many people around the country who are now working toward changing the way we produce our electricity. And we probably haven't got to a point where we're using another process for smelting yet or making steel. But there's a lot of people working all over the country and around the world to start converting from fossil fuel generation to renewables.
Jim,
I think, but it depends on where the electricity comes from that's most important in that case.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's where we have to go, and pretty soon it'd be smart. Instead of waiting for the worst effects, we could shortcut them and reduce the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and return to the climate of the 1980s instead of making a worse climate. Indefinitely into the future. And thanks a lot.
All right, Jim, thank you for your call from Eagle River. Next to Homer and Tom. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tom.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out, I think we got to be awful careful of our priorities and realize the dangers of fossil fuel and nuclear. And there's about 500 nuclear plants around the world, and if we get 500 nuclear plants failing because of a solar flare, and the last solar flares were 1860 and 1920, and either one of those would have taken down the entire electrical grid. We'll have 500 nuclear plants that are spewing out all kinds of, make the Earth unlivable. So I think we got to watch our priorities.
Well, I agree that we certainly have to look at local distribution, generation and distribution of energy, so that we're not relying on huge power plants of any kind, really, that are far away. If you have smaller distribution and generation systems, you're much more local and much less vulnerable.
But a solar flare would take down all those nuclear plants, and they'd all go into a crisis.
Well, I'm not ready myself for any more nuclear power plant crises. I think we had quite enough of those already. That's what I think, anyway. I think we're all kind of looking at that the same way, but I'm sure there's a number of callers who would be more than happy to to go the other way on that one.
Right, and just to be clear, you know, we at REAP, Renewable Energy Alaska Project, are focused on renewable energy, and that doesn't include nuclear. It includes hydro, tidal wave power, biomass, solar, geothermal, wind, and so on. So we're really focused on promoting those types of generation.
Tom, thanks for your call from Homer.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Ellie joins the program from Talkeetna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ellie.
Great. Hi, Steve and Chris. Glad to have you on the program today. My question relates to the proposed Sitna-Watana Dam project.
You're not going to get Chris out on a limb on that one. I'll tell you that right now.
Nope, not out on a limb. But my question relates to, we've started the FERC scoping process, and I'm trying to get educated on this whole thing. And my question relates to this being a huge project, in the order of about $4.5 billion, which is about twice what our annual whole budget for the state of Alaska is.
Well, that's not true.
Listening to the various testimony on this, and it sure seems like they're putting the cart before the horse on this. And what I'm looking for is information about a realistic evaluation of alternatives. It seems like we're throwing a whole lot of money into one project and putting the cart before the horse, so to speak. And I was wondering if you could comment about if it exists or how to get the state to do an entire energy evaluation that includes such things as a needs assessment. What do we need in the way of energy? What are the alternatives to go about supplying that energy? And a cost-benefit analysis to get to where we need to be going, instead of just jumping on, somebody proposed this, oh, that sounds like a good idea, let's do it. Any ideas on how to get a realistic picture of the whole picture?
Well, before we put Chris on the spot, I will say that let's get the state to do that type of study. And I think if you would go to the Alaska Energy Authority, you'd find that they feel that they already have done that sort of study. So I would suspect that you'll need to go somewhere else to get that kind of study done.
Well, Ellie, yeah, I was going to mention that the Energy Authority has funded a study called the Rail Belt IRP, or Rail Belt Integrated Resource Plan, that came out in 2009 or 2010. And that talked about a number of different options in the state and looked at some of the factors and criteria that you mentioned. And then AEA came out with a decision document in early December of 2010, where they basically made the choice to move forward on Susitna or Watana. And then, of course, the FERC process will be also a big part of that evaluation. And so what you've got in the past are those two documents. I mentioned the regional IRP for the rail belt and the decision document at AEA, and then the whole FERC process moving forward. I am not aware of any other outside evaluations that have been completed. So I would first look at those two documents that the state has.
Mm-hmm. Because it sure seems like it's not coming out of all the things that you're talking about on this program with the geothermal and small hydro versus 800-foot-tall dam, many, many other sources that are available. And it seems like we're throwing all our money into one basket here instead of getting a good variety, all the pieces of the puzzle, so to speak, to meet all of our energy needs.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the main criticisms I've heard, Ellie, is that there's a lot of opportunity cost and all that money and, you know, that one project. On the other hand, I'm hearing people say, well, it's a 100-year project, and we want the government to start looking 50, 100 years down the road. And so I think that's where the tension is between those two different concepts.
And, Ellie, I really think that those who oppose the project in particular, or those who look at that type of money and think maybe it should be better spent elsewhere, probably need to keep working on their numbers. I mean, I really think the argument is, in this case, is in the numbers themselves. And what are the realistic possibilities for all these other sources and what really can be done? It's one of the reasons why I brought up realistic load management, which I don't think we're doing at all right now, as one thing that we need to be looking at. And I think there are many others that the numbers that, if you look at from your point of view, the numbers that AEA are using, maybe those are flawed numbers, and maybe you can make a case that they're flawed.
Yeah, and it definitely seems like it's hard to get a hold of accurate, realistic numbers Certain things have been left out from the estimates. As we well know in other places, this kind of project is well known for cost overruns. And I won't get into all the other arguments for dams being taken out in other places, but it just seems like there's a whole lot of confusion out there and that a whole lot more thought needs to be put into this whole thing.
Well, you know, Ellie, I think this goes back to what I said earlier, which is that people need to know where their energy is coming from and the implications of their energy decisions. And more people just need to understand what the scene is here, because we have been really relying on natural gas for a long time. That's becoming very volatile. We've got 10 or 12% of the world's coal in Alaska, and a lot of people don't want that to be burned. So it kind of boils down to what are we going to do moving forward? And those are the kinds of factors that people have to consider when they're making the decisions.
Ellie, I think something that we just got to talk about a whole lot more, and I want to thank you for your call from Talkeetna.
Exactly. Total agreement. We need to keep shopping in many places. So thank you for taking my call.
All right. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Providence Imaging Center, with three locations, including its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, and digital X-rays to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com.
And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
We're talking to Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. And Chris, it's pointed here by Joshua that Ocean Resources was at the last conference, I think. Ocean Resources Project on the Kenai. The important source of water power for Alaska is the water flowing by so many villages. And Ocean Resources from Maine was at the conference last year?
Ocean Renewable Power Company,
right?
ORPC, okay. Which is a company out of Portland, Maine, also has an office here in Anchorage, and they're the ones who'd like to do the first pilot tidal power project.
Oh, that's the one she's talking about.
We're trying to do it in Kinnickarm
at one point. Yeah.
Right, and then they've moved it to various places where they're looking at testing it, but I think Nikiski's the most likely first pilot for ORPC.
So it's still going.
Absolutely. I mean, they're still moving
forward.
They're
here. They have an office here.
They have an office here. They have employees here. They do have a big focus on their project in Maine, and they actually were the second company in the country to get a FERC license for a commercial project. So they're right behind Verdant. And we're lucky to have a company like that investing in Alaska.
Oh, that's great. So we're hearing from both of them up here. That's great.
That's right. Well, ORPC, I do not think is on the agenda, but they will be there.
Well, they were
there.
Last year.
They will be there, yeah.
You know they'll be there. It's their business. Let's go to Patrick, joins the program from Ketchikan. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Patrick.
Hello, Patrick Charles calling from Ketchikan, Alaska. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the maintenance of tidal generators. I know that here in Southeast Alaska during the summer season we have an incredible abundance of marine growth, which will grow on anything that isn't moving at a high rate of speed. And I was curious as to what the factors of removal of marine growth, if it's a turbine system from the blades, any of that type of technology.
Sure.
I would like a...
Well, I don't have the details on how to actually deal with those problems. I just do know that that is really essentially what the nut is that we have to crack, which is how do we maintain tidal and wave power projects in a way that makes them cost effective? Because we know that these devices will make electricity. What we don't know yet is what is the optimum design that's robust enough to not pull out of the water all the time for maintenance. Like you're saying, that's one of the issues. We've got a bunch of silt here in Upper Cook Inlet. We've got marine mammals we have to deal with. These are all the issues that the tidal and wave power industry is really dealing with. When they get to an optimum design, though, what they'll be able to do is start scaling up production and reducing the cost of making those machines. So we're still in that pre-commercial stage where they're working out details like the one you brought up.
I see. And another, well, with tidal power anyway, wave generation also is the, you know, the state of waves is not constant, nor is the flow of the tide constant. So you have a slack period, both high and low. And
But I will say that, of course, that's true. A tide's going to be in a cycle, but and some tides are bigger than others. But usually these tidal projects will use just a tiny, tiny portion of the whole tidal flow.
Well, the nice thing about Cook Inlet, for instance, is we've got so many different places where you could install a project up and down Cook Inlet where there are different times of the tide. So first of all, tides are predictable. So unlike wind, which you cannot predict, or solar, which you cannot predict, you can predict tidal energy, and you could even put in enough so that you would have a predictable source almost all the time, and that becomes, it starts looking like a baseload resource if you're able to do that. Wave energy is different. You cannot predict that. But tidal energy's got that predictability that's a great advantage.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Bruce Wright just chimed in saying ORPC has got a project that's funded by DOE at Falls Pass that they'll be doing a feasibility on this summer.
Yeah, and these are the kinds of projects that are really dependent in large part on the Emerging Energy Technology Fund and the private investment that we're getting here in the state. So it's really gratifying to see so many companies moving in to see what they could do with technology here in the state and hopefully produce electricity and heat for the benefit of the citizens.
Patrick.
Is the storage battery capacity, I know there's some very high-tech storage systems out there now, and is it, are they, do you think they'd be economically viable for a paltry power consumption that small towns in Southeast Alaska have? Do you think there could be a storage capacity in future battery technology?
Absolutely. That's what we're all working toward. That's one of the emerging technologies that we'd still like to see improve. Kotzebue is testing some batteries right now. University is testing batteries. Kodiak Electric wants to put a battery system into their wind hydro hybrid system that they've got out there. But if you look at battery technology over the last 40 years, it hasn't moved as fast as a lot of the other technologies. And so, again, more R&D in that area is really necessary.
Patrick, great call from Ketchikan. I want to thank you so much for your engineering turn of mind there.
Well, thank you very much. And good luck with all those projects because they are very important to the future of this planet.
Right. And
thank you.
And the closer you get, the more complicated they become, it seems. And after a while, you just get to all these. Chris, we have a lot of questions you couldn't answer. That was great.
Well, I wanted to mention that at the conference, there's a free exhibit hall at the Dedina Center on the third floor. And a lot of exhibitors will be there with booths and information. And so if people want to wander in for free, on April 19th and 20th, third floor of the Dedina Center, we'd love to have them.
Okay, Business of Clean Energy in Alaska coming up 19th and 20th at the Dedina. Thanks so much, Chris Rose, for being with us today.
Thank you, Steve.
And, of course, we'll be revisiting the subject. You can bet on that. Thanks to our crew. I'm Steve Heimel. So long.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.